Yeah, well, thank you, Lars. Well, thank you for the invitation. I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators, some students working with me at SDSU, Emil Polosinski and Brodney Fitzgerald, and Mark Helis was at Utrecht. He's moved on to different things, extragalactic stuff in the meantime. And Charles Balin was my thesis advisor at Yale, and these were very frequent collaborators throughout my graduate student career. Now, I'm going to discuss how we observe black holes. Okay. So I'll briefly define what a black hole is. I mean, not that that needs defining, but I'll do it anyway. And then there are three classes of, or three ways we observe black holes in our galaxy. And I'll talk about all those. Now, you can define a black hole in terms of classical gravitation. Of course, that doesn't work, so you use general relativity. So I'll briefly go over definitions, and I'll give you an astrophysical definition of what a black hole is for practical purposes. So this idea in classical gravitation goes back to 1793. And, you know, in Newtonian gravity, you can just write down the escape velocity, right, in terms of gm and r, okay, so. And Mitchell said, well, if you make the star small enough or for a given radius, if you make it massive enough, the escape velocity is going to be higher than the speed of light. And back in those days, they had the corpuscular theory, and, you know, if you make the escape velocity higher than the speed of light, then light's going to be trapped, and star is dark. So it's, you know, can't really argue with that. I mean, you're going to have a dark star because light won't escape. Okay. Now, of course, Einstein comes along, and with his theory of relativity, he has a very different way of looking at gravity. Okay, so gravitation is due to curved space. And so I got these from Kip Thorne's websites. These are the sort of diagrams you see. This, of course, space is three-dimensional, so you draw two-dimensional pictures and try to extrapolate it. Ordinary space is flat, and you have massive gravitating bodies. But in, you know, of course, in Einstein's theory, space is curved, and massive bodies make the curvature more extreme. And so what a black hole really is the extreme case when the curvature becomes so intense that essentially the redshift is infinite. And so light can no longer escape from this region because the curvature is too great. Now, if you look, define the radius as sort of, you know, the circumference divided by 2 pi, the radius you get is the same as what you would get in Newton's, in the classical sense. So a black hole is a region of space-time. It's the curvature is essentially infinite, so there's escape velocity is infinite. And in GR, there's only three things that you need to specify a black hole: the mass, which I'll talk about extensively, the spin, and the charge. And that's it. I mean, there's no other properties you can assign to a black hole. Now, there's no surface, but if you define the radius around that, at least in the two-dimensional analog, around the neck, divided by 2 pi, the radius comes up to be 2 gm over c squared. And if the sun were a black hole, it would be about 3 kilometers for the Schwarzschild radius. And it scales linearly with the mass. So you double the mass, you double the Schwarzschild radius. Okay. Now, we need an astrophysical definition. And the way we do that is by process of elimination. And so when we look up in the sky, we see all sorts of objects. We see stars and planets and other things. And this is a plot from Richard McCrae's website, basically plotting the radius versus the mass. Now, ordinary stars lie along this line here. And so as you get higher and higher in mass, the main sequence star gets bigger. Okay. Now, degenerate objects like planets like Jupiter and white dwarfs would fall on this curve. Now, white dwarfs, you see this line here sort of starts sloping downwards. So there's a point in the Chandrasekhar mass when the white dwarf is no longer stable, so you kind of jump down here to the equivalent neutron star curve. Now, the Chandrasekhar mass is well known. It's pretty well calculated. The equivalent mass for a neutron star when it becomes, you know, that slope becomes straight up and down is not well known, but it's typically taken to be less than 3 solar masses. So a neutron star is thought to be unstable when its mass exceeds around 3 solar masses. And so if you find a compact object with a mass greater than 3 solar masses, it can't be a white dwarf, it can't be a neutron star, and by process of elimination, it must be a black hole. And so my astrophysical definition is of a black hole is a compact object with a mass greater than 3 solar masses. You know, compact is important because you can have a B star with, you know, 6 solar masses. So you have to demonstrate compactness and a high mass. And if you do that, the black hole is the most conservative interpretation, I would say. Okay. So we're looking for something very, very small and very, very massive. So the question is, where do you look for these? Now, in the 60s, there were several ideas put forth. And there's a paper by Trimble and Thorne in APJ in the late 60s. They said, well, let's look at spectroscopic binaries. They had these catalogs. We'll look for cases where you see a single line binary and indications of a massive dark companion. Now, the idea is, for at least for main sequence stars, the higher your mass, the greater the luminosity. The luminosity goes like the mass of like 3.5 or 4th power or something like that. And so if you see something like a K star, which is intrinsically faint and it has a massive companion, if it were a main sequence star, it should be bright and should be seen. So the idea is you look for massive dark companions. Now, they had 8 good candidates, but none of them were confirmed because of errors of various sorts. Like if you have a triple, you put 2 5 solar mass stars, it's much fainter than a single 10 solar mass star. So if you had a hierarchical triple, you can be fooled. I know of algols with massive accretion disks that actually hide the star. So you have mass in a main sequence star, but the light is being hidden by a disk. So there's all sorts of ways the lawyers can argue and get out of these. So none of these candidates are confirmed today. The other way approach was suggested by Zoldovich. You look for signs of accretion. Now, either from the ISM, you know, there's gas out there. If the black hole is moving through space, it should capture some gas. Or you look for signs of accretion from a companion. Now, that last idea is the one we use because it's the most practical. Now, if you look up in the sky in X-rays, it's actually fairly simple. I mean, there are only a couple hundred really bright sources. Here's the whole galaxy as seen from HEO-1. Now, if you made the optical map, of course, there are billions of stars. So, in the X-rays, at least, there aren't that many sources to look at. Most of these bright objects here must be powered by accretion onto something very tiny.
That's still the best all sky map at 20 kilovolts, right?
Yeah, I think so. Well, the sky is a big place. And it's, you know. This was in the 70s, the late 70s, I think, HEO-1.
How many sources?
Oh, there's a couple hundred. For example, this would be, I believe that's GLOX-1. I think this is the crab. You know. It's well, fairly low energy, though. This is much higher, harder X-rays.
It's 20 kilovolts.
Yeah. So, well, when people first saw bright X-ray sources, this was a surprise. And so natural question is, well, what are these? Now, there's some basic observations you make. First is the rapid X-ray variability on sometimes millisecond timescales. So you need very tiny sources, you know, a few hundreds of kilometers. I mean, not like the sun, or much, much smaller than the sun. So very, very tiny sources. In rare cases, you see regular eclipses. So that's obviously, it's a binary. Okay, you don't see eclipses obviously all the time, but in some cases you do see the eclipses, so you know these are binaries. So these X-ray sources are basically binaries containing very tiny objects, because we know they're tiny because of the variability, and they're binaries. And so we're going to look for black holes in the X-ray binaries, basically. Now, roughly speaking, there are two classes of X-ray binaries, the high-mass ones with high-mass companions and the low-mass. And it's basically an either-or. I mean, there's not a continuous range for various reasons. So typically, you have 10, 15 solar mass companions, 20, or you have like one or two. You never, or very rarely, have in between. And that's basically because of the way the mass transfer works. In high-mass stars, you need a stellar wind. So at some point, the star doesn't have enough mass to give you a good wind. On the low end, it's typically Roche-Loeb overflow. And so if the mass is too high, then that, if the the star gets too high, then in a lot of cases that's unstable because it's more massive than the compact object. So you see these two general classes. So we have either O stars, B stars, the stellar wind giving you the mass source, or K stars, G stars, something like that, giving you mass transfer via the Roche-Loeb overflow. And then out of these, there are two sort of subclasses: persistent sources, which are always bright in X-rays, and transients, which are seldom bright. They flare up. And these transient sources are the most efficient sources for black holes, which I'll discuss why. Now, the all-sky monitor on XTE is a very nice, let's see if I can get this thing going, instrument. It's this one of three instruments on the Rossi X-ray Timing Explorer. And it's basically this camera that spins and scans the sky continuously. Now, every day, most of the sky is observed from like 5 to 10 times in the range of like 2 to 12 or 2 to 10 keV, something like that. And so you get, basically, you get daily snapshots of most of the sky. And so if you see flaring sources like that one we just missed there, you're going to notice it, okay, because you're observing the sky all the time. And so you see lots of persistent sources like SCOX1, the crab. But that source, see if I can rerun this thing, I believe that was 1655 minus 40, and one of its flares, it just like popped out of nowhere. And so the X-ray, the ASM is a very good instrument to pick up flaring X-ray sources, because as I said, there's not that many to confuse you, and when they flare, they're pretty bright. So it's like having a star as bright as Sirius, you know, just appear out of nowhere, and there's having only 10 or 12 stars in the whole sky. So it's pretty easy to notice when these happen. Let's see. It won't let me out of this. Oh, there it goes. So here's an example of an X-ray transient. This is the source 4U1543-47. It was discovered in the 70s. And XTE observed an outburst in 2002. So here we have data from ASM. This is time versus counts. It's basically undetected. Then it flares up to 300 counts per second. So this is about 4.5 times the flux of the crab. So it's a very bright source. So fast rise, and it just had this exponential decay. And then now it's undetected.
Is that weird?
Solar flare, I think. These are explainable by. XTE 1550 was discovered in 1998, 3 days before the HST proposal deadline. So I got something like a week, got distracted. Very bright source, 12 times the Crab Nebula at its peak, died down, then it had these sort of reflares. And I think that's a real detection. There is a very, very weak one there. So it had like 4 or 5 reflares after the main flare. And so what we do is we wait for X-ray transients to be detected usually by the ASM. And then the X-ray positions typically aren't that great, you know, because you're scanning the whole sky, so you can't get very good positioning. So when there's an X-ray source detected, we look in the optical and the radio and look for a flaring source, so to identify the source. And here's the example with XTE 1550. We get an IAU circular saying there's this new source in, you know, this direction. And it happened to be night, you know, and in the right place. Sometimes these are too close to the sun to see optically, but this was nighttime. So we took a picture. And lo and behold, there's a source which is very bright, you know, September 8, 1998, bright here, but it's faint in the digitized sky survey. And that's a good indication that these two sources are connected. I mean, you need spectroscopic confirmation, which was obtained. And so now that we have the optical counterpart, you say it's this star here, we can, you know, write that down and study it later. And here's the light curve, the V-band light curve. It was, you know, 17th magnitude. It dropped. During the X-ray reflare, it flared up to 16th magnitude and faded. And so you see, every X-ray flare has sort of an optical counterpart. In this source, though, the optical X-ray, you know, brightness is not constant. So during the first flare, it was its brightest in the X-rays. last flare, it was barely detected in the X-rays, but the V-band, sort of similar. So the X-rays and opticals are correlated, but there's not, you know, a fixed, rigid relationship. It's sort of, you know, sometimes it's strong here and weak there and vice versa. And I don't know why that would be, but it's complicated stuff going on there. Okay, so we find these sources. Now, what do we do to...
I was just thinking of all these people who are doing all sky surveys all the time now. That was, in the end, what's the distance of this object? Is this 5, 10 kiloparsecs?
Oh, it's about 5 kiloparsecs, plus or minus some big number, yeah. Reddening is a real problem, so it's basically guess. So we've identified the source optically, so we have a star. What we do is we wait for the X-rays to die down, and we just do classical binary star work and study the companion. So it's taking photometry and spectroscopy. Now, a quick tutorial on Kepler. We just take a time series of radio velocity measurements, and if you have a circular orbit, you're going to see a sine wave, right? And so the sine curve is characterized by a center of mass velocity gamma, a phase time, or a phase reference T0, the period, and then the semi-amplitude K2. Now, if you have a circular orbit with two stars, the velocity of the star is simply the circumference. Oops, there should be an A there. 2 pi A over P. So it's the circumference of the orbit divided by the period times this thing to get the center of mass, right? Kepler's third law says period squared is proportional to A cubed. So you just combine those two, and you can write down this equation here for the mass function, which is period times K2 cubed over 2 pi G. So these are observed quantities. You measure the period, and you measure the K. And this is called the mass function in the binary star nomenclature. So the mass function is just these observed quantities. And it can be related to the mass of the unseen companion of the unseen star, the mass of the companion star, and the inclination of the binary's orbit. Now, you can see here that the mass function sets a lower limit to the mass of the dark companion, or the dark star there, because the mass of the companion has to be greater than zero, and sine I has to be less than 1, less than or equal to 1. So if you measure the mass function, you know that the mass of the dark object is greater than that number. Okay, and that's a pretty firm statement. So by simply getting the radial velocity curve of the companion, you have a minimum mass for the dark object there. Okay. And there's basically no assumptions except for Kepler's law here. So assuming you haven't screwed up your period or anything like that, this is a very good measurement. People have screwed up the periods, of course, in case, but once they get the mistakes, there's no assumptions here. So here's some examples. AO620, the prototype, flared in 75. The K velocity is 443 kilometers per second. The period's about 8 hours. So the mass function is 2.9 solar masses. 1124 minus 683, it erupted in 91, I think. The mass function is almost the same, but the period's a little bit longer, and the K is a little smaller. But, you know, mass function's 3 here. 1655 minus 40, the period's 2.6 days. The K is about 218, I think, so the mass function's 2.73. Okay. And the latest thing I've been working on is 4U1543 minus 47, that outburst I showed you, the first plot. Mass function here is tiny, it's only 0.22 solar masses. But we've got a very good curve going back to 1987 at Cerro Tololo. Now, out of all these X-ray transients, we've got something like 18 measured mass functions. There are 13 with mass functions close to or greater than or equal to about 3. And I list these in order that they were measured, okay, starting with the AO620. We have 3 systems, X-ray transients, with very small mass functions, 0.22. Now, the reason this one's in this column is there was an error. There was announced a period and a K velocity that was incorrect. And the original announced mass function was 0.6. So it was in this column here, but I corrected this. It's 2.7, but I didn't have room to move it down here. And then we have three systems with massive secondaries. The textbook example is SIGX-1. It has an O-star companion. That's, you know, if you read any astronomy textbook, you'll see SIGX-1 mentioned. The mass function there is only 0.25 solar masses. And there are a couple of sources that are sort of equivalent in the LMC, LMCX-1, and LMCX-3. So this gives us something like 19 systems with measured mass functions. And then there's maybe two, you know, 24, something like that, sources where we think they're black holes based on the X-rays, but we haven't studied them optically. Now, I would claim that sources down here, you know, like 1859 with mass function of 7.4, you know, V44 sig, mass function is 6. These are black holes no matter what you do. I mean, the minimum mass here is 6 solar masses. And you can't really spin up a neutron star and expect it to be stable at these high masses. You know, you can maybe argue with this that maybe you had some weird situation. But when you're getting like 6 or 7 solar masses or 9, the most conservative explanation is you have a black hole. Now, those were just mass limits, just the mass function. Okay, so if we want actual masses, you know, to study these in more detail, what do we have to do? Well, you look at the equation for the mass function. And again, it's these observed quantities. And with algebra, you equate it to the mass of the dark object, the inclination of the orbit, and the mass of the companion. So if you want to know the mass of the dark object, you need to specify the inclination and the mass of the partner. Or you can specify the inclination and the mass ratio. Now, physically, what you're doing, you want to know actual orbital velocities instead of projected velocities, right? So you need the inclination, because the actual velocity tells you the mass, okay? So inclination is needed to get the projection. And also, you need to know the distance from the center of mass of the visible star, okay? And that's where the mass ratio enters in, because you need to know how far it is away from the center of mass so you can make that correction. So to solve for the mass of the black hole, we need the inclination and the mass ratio. Now, the inclination can be found from, this goes back to classical binary stars. The reason these sources are X-ray sources is because the companion star is filling its critical Roche lobe and is losing matter to accretion disk, and that's giving you the X-rays. Now, you can compute what the star should look like, and it's going to be highly distorted by the tides. And it's going to look something like a teardrop. Now, as the star goes in its orbit, you see a different projection of this teardrop. So sometimes you see it end-on, and sometimes you see it side-on. Therefore, you expect to see a different flux, because you have more area here than here. And so I've drawn a schematic of what you should expect to see in the velocity and then in the light over the orbit. So here at conjunction, you see the minimum area, so you see the minimum light, and it's crossing the plane of the sky, so you see zero velocity. At quadrature, as it's gone from here, it's going away from you at the maximum velocity, so you see a peak here, and it's also the maximum area, so you see a bright. Then at the other conjunction, when it's behind the black hole, you see the minimum area, and you see a minimum light, and it's a zero crossing in the velocity curve, right? And then at the other quadrature, it's coming towards you, so it's the minimum velocity, and then the maximum light. So you'll see a sine curve in the velocity, and you'll see a double-waved light curve as you observe this thing over its orbit. Now, what's neat about these so-called the ellipsoidal variations is that the amplitude depends very strongly on the inclination and less strongly on the mass ratio. So here I've drawn inclination of 30, inclination of 60 for a fixed mass ratio. So here is 60 degrees, this big, and 30 degrees. And if I go back, you can imagine the limit of seeing exactly face on. You always see the side of the teardrop, right? So there's no variations. And you see the maximum contrast when it's edge on. And so you can compute this quite easily. And then the mass ratio also affects it a little bit. As you go away from mass ratios of unity, the light curves tend to get slightly bigger amplitudes. Now, in the real world, this is what you see. So here's part of Emil's thesis, 1543-47. Here's all the observations, BVI, sort of phased at the spectroscopic period, and here's bend, phased and bend, and you see this double wave. Amplitude isn't that big, it's maybe a tenth magnitude, but it's when you at least make the bend light curve, it's clearly detected. Rodney Fitzgerald spent 40 or 50 nights at Mount Laguna, which is just east of San Diego, up in the hills there, observing XC 1118. And this is what he sees in the V-band. Again, here's just all the data phased and then phased and bend at the spectroscopic period. So a nice double wave light curve. And then here's the more honest and typical example, maybe 1124-683 from 92, 93, 94, 95. So when you phase the data and bend it on the spectroscopic period, you see a double wave feature, but then it's kind of ratty. We don't see equal maxima. In addition, the maxima sort of switched, so this one's higher here than there, and then it kind of reversed itself. And so this is, as I said, more typical, where you don't see the perfect double wave shape that you would expect.
But these are all times within quiescence.
Yeah.
So do you see a lot of just photometric variability in quiescence?
Yeah, in the optical, all the time, yeah.
And you attribute that to what?
Well, I'd assume it's just random variations from the accretion disk. The accretion disk is maybe 20 to 30, 40% of the light.
And,
but on the other hand, though, this is if you just think of the accretion disk as axis symmetric hockey puck, you shouldn't expect any modulation in phase. And so either there is something on the star, like a big star spot, or the disk is not a hockey puck, but it's a wavy, warped, you know, mess. And probably both of those are true, spots and a mess. So to get the inclination, we observe the light curves. Now, we don't see, in classical binaries, you get eclipsing light curves, and that gets you really good inclination. We don't see any eclipsing systems yet for the X-ray transients. Now, how do we get the mass ratio? Well, we do another trick. Here's the correct equation. It's got the A. So, the orbital velocity is just the circumference divided by the period times this factor for the center of mass. Now, the rotational velocity of the star, if it's tidally locked, which it should be because, you know, the time scale to get circularized is pretty short. The rotational velocity of the star is its circumference, so 2 pi times its radius over the period. So the ratio of the rotational velocity to the orbital velocity is simply this. And that's basically a function only of the mass ratio. The radius of the Roche lobe you can compute numerically. And so if you can measure the radius or the ratio of the rotational to the orbital velocity, you can work out what the mass ratio is, assuming the star fills its critical Roche lobe and is rotating synchronously. And those are pretty safe assumptions, because if it's rotating too fast, that's a higher energy situation. So synchronous rotation is the minimum, you know, energy situation, which it should settle down into. And if it's not filling its Roche lobe, it's not going to transfer mass. It's not going to be an X-ray binary, so at these low masses. Now, here's the best case. I wish this was typical, but this is one of the better cases. This is 1543-47. Again, it's one of the brighter sources, and we can go with the 8-meter VLT and the UFI spectrograph. Take a nice Schell spectrum, look at the magnesium 2 line at 4481.2. And basically, you just take your Kurutz models, and you play around with the rotational broadening, and you match the profile, and you find 46 plus or minus 2. Now, the typical case is much worse because these are very faint sources, so you can't get very good spectroscopic data. But nevertheless, you do the best you can. So most of these sources have estimates for the rotational velocity, but some are better than others. Now, putting it all together, well, it's just basically it's an optimization problem. So one can imagine if I tell you the shape of a star and how, you know, the temperatures, that you ought to be able to figure out what the light should look like, right? Because you know what the star shapes are, you know the temperatures. So you ought to be able to compute the flux. Now, of course, it's the reverse, right? You observe the light, and you try to work backwards. And so we have a detailed binary model which gives you the shapes of the stars based on the inclination, the mass ratio, and all that stuff. And temperatures, we have stellar atmospheres in there. And so we, given a model, we can predict what we should see in the velocity time series and the photometric time series. We can predict what the rotational velocity of the star should be, you know, if we know the separation of the period and all that. We can predict what surface gravity should be. If there's an X-ray eclipse, we can predict how long it is. So we have this model which can predict all these observed properties of what you ought to see, okay, when you give the period and all that. Now, of course, you observe what you see, and then you work backwards. So for that sort of inverse problem, I have this nice genetic code. So the idea is you make all these observations, and you find a model which best matches everything you see, like the light curves, the velocity curves, the rotational velocity. And then once you have your model with the inclination, separation, mass ratio, you can compute physical parameters like masses, right, and radii. So what we do is we have all these observables, we have this giant optimization problem with the genetic algorithm, and then we just put everything in a pot and see what comes out. Now here's the best case. I wish this were typical, but this is by far the best case. B4641 Sagittarius. This was a very fast and luminous X-ray transient, something like 12 times the Crab or 13 times. And it's observed to have superluminal jets in the radio. So that's always exciting. Now we've got light curves in U, B, V, R, I, J, H, and K, and we have radial velocities. And we have a good rotational velocity measured with the VLT. So I'm going to put all these things in the pot and take my genetic code and solve for the period and the mass ratio and the separation and the inclination and all these other things. And the result of that model is all these solid lines here. So overall, it fits pretty well. And we get a nice velocity curve here. Light curves are fit pretty well. And then what EMIL's been doing is 1543 minus 47. It's the same thing, but fewer light curves. So we have B, V, and I. And that velocity curve I showed you earlier, plus this rotational velocity, and we do the same thing. We fit for the period, the mass ratio, the inclination, separation. And it's pretty good. It's a little fainter source, and the inclination is a little bit less, but, you know, we get pretty good fits. And then again, the typical example, this is a really faint source, and you don't get that good of a data, you know, so here's observed photometry phased and then phased and bend here. And we have these Sloan filters, the G prime, the R prime, the I prime, Z prime. And, you know, we got gaps in coverage and whatnot, but, you know, overall it's an okay fit, I guess, given that there's not much data. Now, optimizing is actually easy, and as a side effect, we can actually estimate uncertainties pretty well, too, because if I tell you the inclination's, you know, 70 degrees, you want to know the error. So the genetic code is actually very good at doing this, and basically what you do is you compute, or the genetic code computes a large number of models sort of near the minimum. And I can actually give you a separate talk on how this code works. It's kind of neat. But suffice it to say that you've roughly sampled everywhere near the minimum. And then it's a simple matter just to take this chi-squared hypersurface and make projections on the parameters of interest. So in other words, you just plot out the chi-square as you change, like, the inclination, and you see what change in inclination is needed to make the chi-square go up by 1 or something like that. So it's very convenient to compute confidence limits. And here's the example of 4641 Sagittarius. So we have parameters here, like period, inclination, we have chi-square. And parameters like the period are pretty well constrained. You know, you have these nice minima. Parameters like the effective temperature of the star are not so well constrained here, or the radius of the accretion disk. Mass ratio is a little bit screwed here. Now, every time you compute a model, you can compute physical parameters. And so you save those set of parameters, you save the chi-square, and then you can make the same plots in computed parameters like the mass of the black hole, mass of the companion, radius of the companion.
This is a Markov chain code, essentially.
I'm not familiar with that. But what you do is you have like 100 random parameter sets, and you compute chi-square. And then you have this algorithm which sort of takes the best parameter sets and kind of combines so that you breed them and you exchange certain parameters and you compute more. And the ones that do well survive more and breed more, and the ones that don't die off. And it's a great way to optimize, but you need a lot of models. And so it's not for, you know, like your pocket calculator, but you need pretty fast computers. And so when you look at the computer parameters, so these are very well constrained because you get these nice, well-defined minimum. And so the mass of the black hole in this case is 7 plus or minus 0.3, not 3. I'll probably fix that. Mass, yeah. I had this distinct memory of changing that typo. But mass of the companion is 2.9 plus or minus 0.2, and the radius of the companion is, you know, 5.6. So that's a pretty good example. From Emil Cesis, same thing for 1543 minus 47. Inclination here is about 21 degrees, so almost face on. And the black hole mass is about 9.4 solar masses. Okay. Now,
sorry, can I ask
you? Yeah.
So Emilio's was here last week, and we had a long discussion about inclinations of orbits and
Right. Which
way the jet's going.
Right. And they're not aligned. Well, the jet is not perpendicular to the orbit.
Excellent.
Well, in this case here, it's pretty ridiculous, because to get that high proper motion, like 0.2 arc seconds a day or something like that, you need the jet essentially right at your face. But the inclination here is 75. So there's a huge mismatch. Now, with this particular system, there's some question of when the ejection began, because they only have a few snapshots. But I mean, no matter how you work it, there's no way you're going to get the jet to be 75 degrees, I think.
But how many cases?
Just
how many?
Two.
Two where you've got two.
Right, because in 1915, people assume the inclination is the same as the jet, but they've never independently measured the inclination there.
So how many binaries do you have two independent measurements, and you can ask?
Just two. Just two.
Two binaries.
Yeah.
Neither agrees.
XT 1550, they didn't have phase closure or some technical reason, so they didn't get a really good inclination, I think, for that one. Now, ellipsoidal models aren't the problem here. I mean, we can compute these things pretty well. You know, this basic Roche geometry and model atmospheres and all that stuff. And in a few cases, we get excellent agreement, you know, like 1655. In the typical case, like XC 1550 or 1124 minus 683, you see variable light curves. So they change from year to year. And so you don't know what's going on. Okay, so there's something else happening that's not in the models. And so what you do is you either suffer or you try something else. In some cases, when you look in the infrared, you see more stable light curves that tend to repeat. But the infrared is much harder to obtain than optical for various reasons, although that's becoming less true these days. And so the models aren't the problem here, it's just the systems themselves, because you're never sure when you observe the true pure ellipsoidal variation. And typically you have this extra light, which may be the disk or maybe star spots. And so I think in a few good cases we have high confidence, and in a typical case we have, you know, less than high confidence.
Actually, as long as this question begs the question on this, if it's true that the plane of the inner disk is not on the plane of the orbit,
Yeah. Then
the disk is definitely not a pod. I mean, it's highly warped.
The question is, what is the radius of the warp?
It's upwards, yeah, it's different.
Yeah.
Well, even in quiescence.
But, yeah. Well, I mean, the simple model.
You're saying that the disk life is only 30-40% of the.
Yeah, and in these cases, it's actually unobservable, and because these have very bright companions.
I see.
But the naive model is you have sort of a two-zone disk, so you have like a tilted thing and then a flat thing, and you would expect sort of a sine, or a single wave added to your light curve. Just based on the rotating, but if the disk is sort of oblong or if it's got spiral waves, then who knows. So I'm not nearly smart enough to compute anything like that. So I just do the hockey puck.
Okay.
So here's our picture. Now these are schematic diagrams with correct shapes for the stars and correct scales and distance. So here's the Sun to Mercury. So give you some idea of the scale. So these three sources up here have the O and B stars, so SIGX1, LM6X1, LM6X3, and then these are all transients. So GRS 1915 plus 105 is this superluminal source that's obscured by something like 30 magnitudes in the optical, so it's very difficult to study. You need infrared. And so basically what you're seeing here is the orbital period, because Kepler's third law says perioded, you know, squared is proportional to A cubed. So this has a long period, and this one has a short period. And that's the main reason for the physical sizes. Okay. And you see, most of them are very, the color is sort of the temperature, so darker things are cooler stars. Most of these are K stars. This is a B9, this is an A star, or this is an A star, this is like an F star. Now, when you look at masses, here's the mass versus, you know, the system. These are all known to be neutron stars because they're either pulsars or they display X-ray bursts. So a black hole is not allowed to have an X-ray burst, or it's not allowed to be a pulsar. Now, most of the pulsars that you get these really good masses are all clustered around 1.35, the Hulse-Taylor pulsar. The only system that seems to be significantly above 1.4 is VLX1. And there's problems with pulsations in the B star, which sort of distort the velocity curve. So all the neutron stars, you know, with good measured masses are all down here. And these things we call black holes are all up here and all over the place. So what I've shown here is sort of the kind of one sigma mass ranges, and these are the mass functions, these little arrows. And so, for example, a good case here, 46, 41 Sagittarius, or where is that? This one here. Fairly small error bar here. This is the one with the nice light curves. But in other cases, like 1915 plus 105, we have to guess at the inclination, we have to guess at the mass ratio. Mass function is quite high, but we get this big range here. And so there are two things you can say. One is that there are a wide range. You know, you can't really put your stick down here and say that they all go through there. The other thing is that there seems to be a gap between the neutron stars and the black holes. And so there's maybe at best one or two systems, black holes, where there's about four solar masses. And models of supernova or black hole production in supernova would predict lots of three and four solar mass black holes. So basically they predict a power law distribution. Lots of low mass ones and very few high mass ones. Now, obviously, this is a very biased sample because these are all in X-ray binaries, and you have to bend over backwards to make an X-ray binary that you can observe. Okay. Now, how can you observe isolated black holes? Well, one way is microlensing. And as I showed you in those earlier plots, you know, Einstein says matter distorts space, and light is going to be bent as it goes near gravitating objects. And so if you arrange a massive object and put it in front of a background object, there's a possibility that you can make a lens, right? And you see these all the time in, you know, galaxy clusters, right? You see these arcs of a foreground cluster is distorting background objects. Now, in microlensing, you don't see the distortion of the source, but you just see a brightening. You don't resolve this, or you don't resolve the source star, but you see it get brighter. Now, there are a couple of microlensing surveys going on, and basically what they do is they look either at the bulge or the LMC, and they just take lots of photometric data, and they monitor the brightness of millions of stars every night. And they've found very convincing cases where they, you know, where we're sure that there's microlensing going on. So you see here sort of the brightness in the blue band, the brightness in the red band, and you see function at time, you have this very characteristic brightening and fading, so this sort of pointy thing. And it's achromatic. The amplitude does not depend on the color. And so these are due to microlensing. So there's something in the galaxy has moved in front of that background star and made it get brighter. Now we've seen probably almost a couple hundred of these by now. So these are fairly common to see. Now this is the time scale of the event. Depends on a number of things, but one of the things it depends on is the mass of the lens. You know, and speed of light and G and all that stuff. But in general, the more massive the lens, the longer the time scale for the event. Now, if you can measure like the velocity of the lens and the relative motion between the lens and the source, which is not trivial, if you can measure these on the time scale, then in principle you can measure the mass of the lens. And so to look for black holes, we want to look for very, very long timescale events. Now, in some cases, the timescale is so long that the Earth is actually moving as you're observing. And that actually helps you figure out some of these other quantities. So it sort of breaks these degeneracies between all these things. Now, there are two good cases where you see extremely long durations. This one's almost 1,000 days. It's Macho 96 bulge number 5. This one is almost 500 days. It's Macho 98 bulge number 6. You know, that's 2.5 years, right? So it's pretty long. Now, the bulge is a crowded place if you ever look there. And so it helps to have HST because from the ground, what you're seeing is you're seeing sort of a sea of stars and you see something get brighter. Now, in this case with HST, they've resolved it and they know, I think it's this star here is the one that got brighter. And we need to sort of know the unlens brightness to sort of, you know, compute the magnification and the time scales. And in the bulge, HST is a way to do that. So those two long duration events, when they put all, you know, do their best fitting, the masses are around 6 solar masses. Now, if you're 6 solar masses and you're a main sequence star, then you should, you know, be pretty bright, okay? And so the fact that they only see the source star, you know, they have a spectrum, it's a K star. So these lenses cannot be main sequence stars or else you'd see them. They'd be B stars. So we have dark lenses which seem to be massive. And these are probably not white dwarfs, but they're, you know, the error bars don't quite overlap the Chandrasekhar mass. So these are good candidates for black holes. Now the third way to see black holes in the galaxy is look at the galactic center. Now of course we've known about the galactic center since the 1900s, and Shapley looked at globular clusters and said there's overabundance near Sagittarius. Right? Now, in the radio, people have been mapping spiral arms and whatnot, and you know, subsequent radio observations have really pinned down where the galactic center is. Now, in the 1970s, there was this very strange source discovered called Sagittarius A star. Now, I actually forgot to put a picture, but when you take a radio image of the galactic center, you see all these supernova remnants, and you see sort of this big, fuzzy, diffuse thing, which is called Sagittarius A. In the middle of Sagittarius A, there's this very compact source, which is very bright, and so it's called Sag A star. And it's unlike any other radio source in the galaxy. It's a unique source. Now, the galactic center is extincted by about 26 magnitudes, and so optical is out of the question. And so if you want to observe Sag A star, you need the radio or the infrared. Now, the angular size of Sag A star actually depends on the wavelength you look. And it turns out this is because of scattering in the interstellar medium, because there's lots of stuff between you and the galactic center. The size you measure scales is the square of the wavelength, and this is what you expect from the scattering. And there's a recent paper, which is going to appear in Science, and they've, with VLBI, they've achieved phase closure, and they've got a good model for the scattering. And at 0.69 centimeters, they measure a size of 0.24 milli arc seconds. Now, if you assume the distance is 8 kiloparsecs, that 0.24 milli arc seconds is 1.9 AU. So that's pretty small, as I'll tell you about. So it's a very small and very bright source. Now, for reasons which I'll explain, we want to measure positions and motions. Okay? Now, it's in the radio, it's actually very easy to do this. With VLBI, you can measure positions pretty accurately. Okay. Now, Sag A star itself is detected, but also you see these SIO maser sources. Now, these bright, compact sources associated with these sort of AGB stars. Now, these major sources are very compact, so you get nice positions, and many of them are identified in infrared. So there's these, you know, red stars, red giants, basically. Now, so the idea is you're going to use these masers in the infrared and the masers in the radio to tie the two systems together. Okay. And so using VLBI, it's possible to observe the position of Sagittarius star very accurately. And you do that over time, you find that there's a proper motion. So the proper motion is 5.9 milliarc seconds per year along the galactic plane. Now, this is just a matter of perspective. Sagittarius star is sitting there and the sun is moving, right, in the orbit. So if you take 8 kiloparsecs and 220 kilometers per second, work out the angular speed, it's 5.9. So what this is a reflex motion of the sun in its orbit about the galactic center. So we measured orts A minus B or something like that, A plus B. So the observations are all consistent with Sagittarius star being stationary at the galactic center. It's the center of motion of the whole galaxy. And so we're pretty sure that Sagittarius star is the dynamical center of the Milky Way. Now, if we wanted to study motions, you need very high resolution. And these days, with speckle or an infrared or an adaptive optics, you can get 0.05 arc second resolution with an 8 or 10 meter telescope. Now, these sources which have circled are these SIO maser sources, which are observed in the radio. And so, using these maser sources, you can tie the infrared coordinate system to the radio and then get absolute reference. And if you've ever taken astrometry from Bill Van Altler or people like that, you appreciate reference frames. You need absolute, you know, motion against an absolute frame. And so we can get, or we, meaning they, can get infrared positions to 10 milliarc seconds in an absolute scale. Now, this is from Genzel's group. Let's see if I can get this thing going here. This is observations starting from 1992 in the K-band. And they see very, very large proper motions. Let's see if we can wind that back again.
Looks like they ran ahead to 2006.
Well, yeah. I was going to say they extrapolated. They cheated. They extrapolated a little bit, but not much. Just a couple years. Now, notice this star. At least in its extrapolated orbit, it's gone around. It's a closed orbit, right? Now, if you work out the proper motions, you know, there's so many milliarc seconds per year. These are like 1,000 kilometers per second motions. It's pretty big, right? Now, this star is called S2, the one that's been observed almost close. You know, the latest, well, from this Nature paper is 2002. I'm sure they've moved it up a little bit. Now, this is a classical visual binary star problem. You see the motion of the star in the plane of the sky. And then you read your classical books like Aitkins or Benendieck, and you just solve the problem. So the period is something like 15 years. Eccentricity is 0.87. And the enclosed mass is 3.7 times 10 to the 6 solar masses. Okay, that's pretty big. That's just classical binary star. Now, later radio velocities, if the inclination is something like 70 degrees, and I think it's sticking out of the plane down here and behind the plane there, the plane of the screen. So they actually have the orientation in three dimensions with velocities. Now, the mass of that source, you need to do a little bit of modeling because there are stars also. So here we have a plot of the radius from Sagittarius star versus the enclosed mass. Now, the orbit of S2 gives you this point here. So the model that they adopt is a combination of a point mass at 2.6 million solar masses plus the star cluster. And basically all those stars you saw there are massive stars. Oops. This is a fairly big cluster of stars. Okay, so there's a lot of mass involved with the cluster. So it's a cluster of stars in a 2.6 million solar mass point. Yes.
There's a million stars, million solar stars in that small
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff there. Because yeah. While you're...
I thought that you couldn't maintain a stable...
No, but look at the scale here. This is radius and parsecs. And so, we're going out to fairly big distance here to get the...
The black hole is inside S2's orbit, which is...
Yeah.
That orbit
yeah.
is pretty far out.
The orbit's...
It's out
yeah. And the...
That orbit is fairly close in, and you know
right.
the black hole is probably within that orbit.
But there is, there is still a lot of material from...
There's still a lot of stars. There's
4 million solar masses inside the orbit.
So there's about a million solar masses. Yeah.
A million solar masses that are from the individual stars.
No, I don't
know. That's not true.
No, it's 2.4
million. Well, yeah, I think.
Oh, per cubic.
Per cubic, yeah.
Oh.
That is. The black hole is what's.
Yeah, down here. Yeah. It is fairly dense, yeah, but it's. I think the. The amount of infrared light is sort of consistent with the masses, I think, that they're getting. All right, so they, apart from Sagittarius Star, they don't need any dark matter, as far as I know. But it's a lot of stuff, because everybody's, gathered there. So it's a point mass and a cluster. Now, the question is, what is Sagittarius Star? Well, I told you the physical size is less than a couple AU. And it's very massive, right? And so the most conservative explanation is it's a black hole, because if you try to make if you had a cluster of O stars or something, you'd see it, and you don't. So let's make a cluster of brown dwarfs, something dark. Well, you can't do that because it'd be so dense it would be unstable. And in fact, they're at the point now where they're ruling out these exotic dark matter alternatives, like fermion balls and things like that, which I don't understand anything about. But the most conservative explanation is Sagittarius Star is a black hole of 2.3 million solar masses.
By massive dense cluster of dark objects like a neutron star?
It'd still be unstable, yeah. You need a lot of, because the size is so tiny, it's basically like the orbit of Mars or less. And that's dynamically unstable. I think nobody's come up with a way to make it, to maintain it. So to summarize, there are several lines of evidence which suggest there are black holes in the Milky Way. The X-ray binaries give us the best. We have a couple dozen, roughly, objects that are too massive to be neutron stars, so they must be black holes. And evidence for a black hole at the galactic center is now extremely strong. I mean, there's no way, I think, to argue that it's something other than a black hole. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Questions?
Is there any evidence to support there being many supermassive black holes at the center? Or is this really just a question of the way
could it be two or three? I don't know. I think eventually there are predictions on what should happen to S2. Because now you're starting to get like GR effects, like with the orbit of Mercury. So if you should get this orbit precessing, and you should get other GR effects. And I would think, given enough time, you could start distinguishing between single black hole versus like a binary black hole or something like that. And once you start getting lots of black holes, then you get this stability issue. This is a combination of Kepler's law and this GR gravitational radiation, which I can't.
Couldn't we see that thing in LIGO?
Well, eventually you would think.
Lisa.
Yeah.
One of those.
Well, it's not completely crazy that if you get galaxy merging, you have the cores, but I don't think there's any reason to suspect in the Milky Way that happened. But eventually we're going to, get better orbits and you'll start to see these. And also there have been talk of observing microlensing as these stars sort of pass in front of the black hole. There's rear GR effects where they're magnified and distorted. And you can possibly observe those. And if you ever get the VLT interferometer working, then you're going to have like 10 or 100 times the resolution here. You know, instead of having a single 8.2 meter, you have the four of them put together with a baseline of 100 meters or so. And that's in danger of working, actually. It's, you know, I would have said, it would, you know, 10 years ago, I would have said it's crazy to do that, but there, it's going to work, I think.
Yeah. Black holes versus neutron stars or versus lower mass objects. There doesn't seem to be a large distinction, mainly because it's like the error bars between the objects that are sitting around one solar mass.
Yeah, here?
Yeah, so the question being basically.
Well, from what I understand, there's some things you can imagine in the future, and two of them are actually getting a good proper motion for this lens star and also a distance. Clearly, well, if you knew the distance to the lens and the distance to the source, that helps a lot, but you can't see the lens. But with like SIM or, you know, Gaia or something like that, it might be possible to get a parallax, or certainly a proper motion, but also a parallax. And I think that will sort of beat down some of these errors, if you get a good proper motion and a good distance.
And more events. Just be
and more, yeah, more events, exactly.
Probe of
yeah.
Masses actually shows this, yeah. Mm-hmm. Distinction between the neutron star white dwarfs and black holes. And if it does, then it says something about how we're observing them.
And also these so-called, what do they call this, the parallax effect when the Earth moves, when you're observing, so something like that. And I've heard proposals to have space missions, so I get a bigger baseline to observe these. Yeah. That also helps.
The outburst of 1543, is that just a nova event of the disk?
It's a disk instability, so you get a huge accretion.
And a lot of the black hole candidates show those kind of with the quick rise in the exponential decay.
Yes, they all do, except the ones that don't. there's a huge variety, actually, of.
Well, for a while, they all had
defaulting of
30 days.
Yeah, they all had FREDs, but now you've got things.
No, but not only just that, but with error bars, they were 30 plus or minus one day.
Yeah.
Right? They were like four or five. They had the same.
But 1543 is a good case of the FRED, but 1550 is not FRED because it has sort of this pointy thing that has a plateau and it falls off.
Can I see the other 1543?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's consistently, I think, during all four of his outbursts, it's basically this same shape. The amplitude's a little different. Like in 83, it was 15 crab or something like that, which would fry Chandra probably today if you observed it.
It's hard for me to have what kind of, how much bigger is it getting? I mean, it's only near.
Yeah, so this is. Well, the dynamic, the quiescent luminosity is a few times 10 to the 31 ergs per second, I think, and the outburst luminosity is almost 10 to the 39. So easily 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 dynamic range. It's 1.11 something something. It's this, yeah. I could tell you to 10 to the 7. Well, yeah. It's 1.1 something, something, something.
Great. So Jerry's here tomorrow. I encourage people to come track him down. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.